We're still studying in the 31st chapter of Ezekiel, and the subject of this chapter is still about the destruction of Egypt and the king of Egypt. And what he's doing in this chapter is comparing the king of Egypt to another great monarch, another great king, who has established a precedent. And he's showing how the king of Egypt is going to be judged according to and be made to follow according to the things that have happened to this other great monarch. And the other great monarch is here the king of Assyria, who was Sennacherib. And Sennacherib was a most powerful king. His monarchy had continued from Nimrod. And as you know, Nimrod was the first person to establish a nation. So when this great kingdom of Assyria actually started, there were very few precedents, if any. It made the rules for kings, for monarchs, and for kingdoms. And so when the king of Egypt then is compared to him, then whatever rules applied to him would also have to apply to the great Pharaoh of Egypt. And last time we'd gotten through the fifth verse, and what he is showing here is that this Assyrian, this Sennacherib, this king of Assyria, was a cedar in Lebanon with fair branches and a shadowing shroud and of a high stature. His top was among the thick boughs. He was the greatest of all the trees, and he's comparing him as a tree in the forest that stood above and had a thicker growth than all the other trees. Verse 4 says, "The waters made him great. The deep set him upon high, with her rivers running around about his plants, and sent out her little rivers unto all the trees of the field." So this was a well-watered tree. He had all kinds of revenue flowing into him. And as a result then, he sent little rivers out to support those round about. They depended upon him for support. Their waters weren't as great as his waters were, but their waters came from him. So that He was looked upon as being the source of strength and life and security for those round about him, not only his subjects, but also the nations round about him. Verse 5, "Therefore his height was exalted above all the trees of the field, and his boughs were multiplied, and his branches became long because of the multitude of waters which he shot forth." So not only was he high, not only was he higher than all the trees of the field, but his boughs were multiplied. He had thick growth. He was a well-balanced tree. He wasn't just a long, slender pole, but he had these boughs that were multiplied, and his branches became long, so that he was a huge tree in every respect, huge in width and huge in height. Verse 6, "All the fowls of heaven made their nest in his boughs, and under his branches did all the beasts of the field bring forth their young, and under his shadow dwelt all great nations." So that this tree was a useful tree, not only being the largest tree in the forest and having thick branches, but the fowls of heaven made their nest in his boughs. Various kinds of birds came there to live. And under his branches did all the beasts of the field bring forth their young. They looked upon him as a place of security and as a great shade to get out of the heat of the sun, and as a place to even bring forth their young. And then he says a more literal thing, "And under his shadow dwelt all great nations." So he's talking about the fact that this great king of Assyria was really the greatest thing around on earth. And Nations, great nations, he says here, all great nations dwelt under his shadow. Nobody overshadowed this great cedar, this great king of Assyria. If you were a nation, if you were a great nation, still you were under this great nation of Assyria. And so from this comparison, you just couldn't get any greater. You couldn't have any more prominence. You couldn't have any more glory. You couldn't have any more honor and respect than the king of Assyria had. Verse 7 further describes, "Thus was he fair in his greatness, in the length of his branches, for his root was by great waters." Now this kingdom was well established. This kingdom had a root that here is described as being by great waters. He was well nourished. He was very secure. He had all of the elements of government established and working in order. He had such a secure position that it was like a tree with the great roots that will hold it securely. And as you know, when talking about a tree, of all the great things we can see above the ground on a tree, there is probably just about as much underneath the ground that we can't see that's involved in the way of the root system. And the root system not only holds it securely into the ground, but the root system is involved in bringing in the nourishment and the water that it takes for this tree to continue to grow and to thrive. And so this great kingdom of Assyria was like that. And he describes that his root was by great waters, so that he had a continual, never-ending source of nourishment, of strength, of sustenance. And of course, we'd have to know that this king brought in great revenues, not only from his own people, but from the surrounding nations, so that he had a continual income that made him strong and rich and powerful. Verse 8, the cedars in the garden of God could not hide him. Now, when he talks about the garden of God, this could be a reference even to the Garden of Eden, because it was in the area of this great kingdom that the Garden of Eden was actually located. But the cedars, which are a great tree, but they couldn't hide him. He stood above them. He was thriving and flourishing and growing and outstanding more than they were. The fir trees were not like his boughs, and the chestnut trees were not like his branches, so that the other trees in the garden just couldn't compare to him. This tree stood out above all other trees. Even though they were all growing in the same garden, this tree was the greatest tree. So he says, nor any tree in the garden of God was like unto him in his beauty. He was a beautiful thing. He was desirable to look upon. He was honored and respected and noted, and no doubt everyone knew about him. So he says in verse 9, I have made him fair by the multitude of his branches, so that all the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him. So there he actually names Eden as being the garden to which he's referring to here. It's as though we were back in the Garden of Eden now, where that everything flourished and grew and did well and prospered well. But even in that setting, even all the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him. He stood out more than. He flourished. He was more prosperous. He was more powerful than all the other trees. And what he's simply saying is, of all the nations on earth, of all the people on earth, of all the institutions that were instituted by man on this earth, none were so powerful, so well known, and so beautiful as this kingdom of Assyria with its king. Now, up to this point, we've seen how the king of Egypt resembles the king of Assyria in pomp and in power and in prosperity, and how he was like him in his greatness. But beginning in verse 10 now, we're going to have a little turn. In verse 10, he's going to show how that he likewise resembles him in his pride. For he says in the 10th verse, therefore thus saith the Lord God, because thou hast lifted up thyself in height, and he hath shot up his top among the thick boughs, and his heart is lifted up in his height. Now, of all the greatness that this king had, he couldn't continue to be humble. He couldn't handle it very gracefully, because his heart was lifted up also. And that's one of the great, great downfalls of man any place, any time. He receives power, glory, wealth, honor. If he's not careful, not only will he be lifted up, but his heart's lifted up also, so that he becomes high-minded. He is filled with pride. And so pride then, as we know, comes before a fall. Pride is the very beginning of corruptions, and then great temptations that go along with pride will enter in, and this will bring about the downfall of the person involved. Well, this happened to the king of Assyria. He was great. But he knew that he was great. And he got to the point that he detested the things of God. He didn't think that anybody or anything or any God, the true and living God, was going to be equal to him. And so he began to act in that manner. In Isaiah, the 36th chapter, we have a very good example of this. It was the time when King Sennacherib had come up against all the defense cities of Judah, and he had taken them, and he had now come to the great city of Jerusalem, and his army was standing before the walls of Jerusalem, and his messenger, Rabshakeh, was giving a speech to the people of Jerusalem, and he was in this speech deriding Hezekiah very muchly. In verse 4, "And Rabshakeh said unto them, Say ye now to Hezekiah, Thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, What confidence is this wherein thou trustest?" And he goes on and shows in this speech that it's no use to trust in the king of Egypt because he's not going to be able to help them. And he even talks about how that it's going to be useless to trust in the true and living God because he won't be able to stand up against him either. He says in the 14th verse, "Thus saith the king, Let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, The Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hands of the king of Assyria. Hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, Make an agreement with me by a present, and come out to me, and eat ye every one of his vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards." So Rabshakeh is telling the people to make an agreement with the king of Assyria. He'll take you out. He'll take you to another land, but he'll give you all the things that you need. He's going to make you captive, but he's promising you these good things. And he's persuading them not to follow the counsel of Hezekiah, their own king. And he says in verse 18, "Beware, lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, The Lord will deliver us. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? And have they delivered Samaria out of my hand?" So what the king of Assyria is doing here is comparing the true and living God to these idols. He said, don't let Hezekiah tell you that your God's going to deliver you. But what about the gods of these other nations? Did they deliver them? Did they save them? I was greater than they were. And so he's going to imply then that he's greater than the God of heaven. So he says in verse 20, "Who are they among all the gods of these lands that have delivered their land out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" So you can see then from this passage the great pride that this king had. He didn't mind going and telling the people that he was greater than their God. He was greater than their king. He was greater than any alliance they might have with anybody else. And so he thought very highly of himself. He was very, very filled with pride. So of all the honor and all the power that he had an equal amount of pride. And so this verse 10 here, is comparing the king of Egypt with the king of Assyria. Sure, the king of Egypt, as we learned previously, also had pride. But the same things that went with the pride of the king of Assyria and brought about his downfall would also be then the thing that would bring about the downfall of the king of Egypt. He's showing here how history is going to repeat itself. He's comparing a great king, the Pharaoh of Egypt, to the greatest of all kings at this time, the king of Assyria. He also teaches another lesson in this passage that is a lesson about human nature, and that is when men's outward condition rises, their minds usually rise with it. They usually get a haughty spirit with it. And so it is very difficult then, it's very rare to find a humble spirit in the midst of great advancements. That's what was happening to these kings. And we must be very careful that we don't let it happen to us, even in a small degree, today. This also teaches the impartiality of God. If the great king Sennacherib of Assyria had to how the judgment of God brought against him because of his pride and haughtiness, even though he was so great and powerful, then the king of Egypt could not expect to have any better plight happen to him because of his pride and haughtiness, even though he has power. And we today, when we see somebody that's suffering because of sin, if we commit the same sin, then we have every reason to expect that we too are going to have to be made to suffer in a similar manner, because God is just not partial when it comes to sin and its punishment and meting out his judgments. Beginning with verse 11, he starts to tell the story of the fall of the mighty Assyrian Empire. There were several great kings of this Assyrian Empire, and they had their ups and downs, but over the years they reigned triumphantly. They were supreme, but at long last there was coming a time when they would have a definite fall. History tells us that Cyaxares, king of the Medes, in the 26th year of his reign, in conjunction with Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign, destroyed Nineveh, and with it the Assyrian Empire. Now this king who was reigning over the Assyrian Empire at that time was Cyaxares, and the year was 607 B.C. Nebuchadnezzar at this time was not at that time the most powerful of kings. Yet afterwards, he became very emphatically the mighty one of the heathen, the most mighty among them, and most mighty over them to prevail against them. So as we read this 11th verse, we learn several important things. He says, I have therefore delivered him into the hand of the mighty one of the heathen. He shall surely deal with him. I have driven him out for his wickedness. The first thing we want to note here is that God is stating quite emphatically that he is the one that's doing this. I have driven him out. God is responsible for this. God does remove and set up the kings at his own discretion. And when God feels that it is time for a king to no longer exist, or a kingdom to no longer exist, then he brings this destruction, this removal about. So this is not some accident of history. This is the God of heaven who is actively participating in the affairs of nations, and he's bringing about the removing of the Assyrian king. He says, I have driven him out. And another thing that we want to note here is that God uses the instruments that he chooses to bring these things about. He'll take one wicked king or kingdom and use him to destroy or to punish another wicked king or kingdom. In this case, he took the kingdom of Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar and the kingdom of the Medes and Cyaxares and used them to destroy the wicked kingdom of Assyria with its present reigning monarch, Cyaxares. And so as we see the affairs of nations being carried on and conducted today, we do not know how much of this is simply a matter of God bringing about his will, using one tool, one weapon, one instrument to punish or destroy or to diminish or to exalt another nation. And as the years go by, then this punished nation may become a tool to be used against yet another nation. And so the great affairs of the world, the great affairs of the nations, the great affairs of the civilizations of men are really influenced and conducted by God, although they may not be even aware that there is a true and living God. Another thing we'll notice about this 11th verse is that this destruction was brought upon the king of Assyria because of his wickedness. That I have driven him out for his wickedness. He had done things that deserved this kind of treatment. It was his wickedness that caused his downfall, that caused God to intervene and cause his downfall. And so it's not just God arbitrarily bringing about these things, but it's because the ones who are being punished or who are being judged have so lived that they deserve it. they have committed enough wickedness that it is just for this to happen to them. And it is so true with us today. Whenever God needs to punish us, when He needs to chastise us, when He needs to correct us for our wrongs, it's our wickedness that has brought it about. We have many times done things that maybe we've gone unpunished for. But when God does punish us, we are justly being punished because we have muchly deserved it because of our wickedness. And so one of the most important things that we can do in the way of observation and in the way of carefulness is to remove wickedness from our lives. Let us eliminate those things that are offensive to God. Let us learn what is pleasing to God and live according to that and rid our lives of the sin, of the transgression, of the thing here that's called wickedness, of the thing that's displeasing to God. And of course, as we're going to see, these very same types of judgments were carried out then against the king of Egypt. It will also be for his wickedness. It's our wickedness. It's man's wickedness that comes between him and God, and that causes God to be forced then into bringing forth some kind of judgment, some kind of punishment, and maybe even total destruction in order to eliminate this great offensive thing that we then build up between us and God. Well, we're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friend.